name? What were the words women used when they tried to express it? Sometimes a woman would say, "I feel empty somehow, incomplete." Or she would say, "I feel as if I don't exist." Sometimes, "A tired feeling. I get so angry with the children, it scares me. I feel like crying without any reason." Friedan wrote out of her experience as a middle-class housewife, but what she spoke about touched something inside all women. The problem lay buried, unspoken, for many years in the minds of American women. It was a strange stirring, a sense of dissatisfaction, a yearning that women suffered in the middle of the 20th century in the United States. Each suburban wife struggled with it alone. As she made the beds, shopped for groceries, matched slipcover material, ate peanut butter sandwiches with her children, chauffeured Cub Scouts and brownies, lay beside her husband at night, she was afraid to ask of herself the silent question, "Is this all?" But on an April morning in 1959, I heard a mother of four having coffee with four other mothers in a suburban development 15 miles from New York, say in a tone of quiet desperation, "The problem." And the others knew, without words, that she was not talking about a problem with her husband or her children or her home. Suddenly they realized they all shared the same problem, the problem that has no name. They began, hesitantly, to talk about it. Later, after they had picked up their children at nursery school and taken them home to nap, two of the women cried in sheer relief just to know they were not alone. The mystique that Friedan spoke of was the image of the woman as mother, as wife, living through her husband, through her children, giving up her own dreams for that. She concluded, "The only way for a woman, as for a man, to find herself, to know herself as a person, is by creative work of her own." In the summer of 1964, in Macomb, Mississippi, at a Freedom House, a civil rights headquarters where people worked and lived together, the women went on strike against the men who wanted them to cook and make beds, while the men went around in cars organizing. The stirring that Friedan spoke of was true of women everywhere, it seemed. By 1969, women were 40% of the entire labor force of the United States, but a substantial number of these were secretaries, cleaning women, elementary school teachers, saleswomen, waitresses, and nurses. One out of every three working women had a husband earning less than $5,000 a year. What of the women who didn't have jobs? They worked very hard at home, but this wasn't looked on as work because in a capitalist society, or perhaps in any modern society where things and people are bought and sold for money, if work is not paid for, not given a money value, it is considered valueless. Women began to think more about this fact in the early 1960s, and Margaret Benston wrote about it, The Political Economy of Women's Liberation. Women doing housework were people outside the modern economic system. Therefore, they were like serfs or peasants, she said. The women who worked in the typical woman's job, secretary, receptionist, typist, salesperson, cleaning woman, nurse, were treated to the full range of humiliations that men in subordinate positions faced at work, plus another set of humiliations stemming from being a woman, jibes at their mental processes, sexual jokes and aggression, invisibility except as sexual objects, cold demands for more efficiency. A commercial guide to clerical time standards printed a question and answer column. Question. I'm a businessman and my secretary seems to move entirely too slowly. How many times a minute should she be able to open and close a file drawer? Answer. Exactly 25 times. Times for other open and close operations are 0.04 minutes for opening or closing a folder and 0.026 minutes for opening a standard center desk drawer. If you're worried about her chair activity, clock her against these standards. Got up from chair, 0.033 minutes. Turn in swivel chair, 0.009 minutes. A woman factory worker in New Bedford, Massachusetts, in the early 70s, in a medium-sized corporation, whose president's dividends from the corporation in 1970 amounted to $325,000, wrote in an organizing newspaper that 9% of the workers in her department were women, but all the supervisors were men. A few years ago, I was suspended for 3 days from work because my children were still young, and I had to take time off when they were sick. They want people who keep quiet, squeal on one another, and are our very good little robots. The fact that many have to take nerve pills before starting their day, and a week doesn't go by that there aren't two or three people who break down and cry, doesn't mean a thing to them. She added, "But times are changing. And from now on, more people will speak out and demand their so-called bosses that they be treated the way the bosses themselves would like to be treated." Times indeed were changing. Around 1967, women in the various movements, civil rights, students for a democratic society, anti-war groups, began meeting as women. And in early 1968, at a women's anti-war meeting in Washington, hundreds of women carrying torches paraded to the Arlington National Cemetery and staged the burial of traditional womanhood. At this point, and later too, there was some disagreement among women, and even more among men, on whether women should battle on specifically women's issues or just take part in general movements against racism, war, capitalism. But the idea of a feminist focus grew. In the fall of 1968, a group called Radical Women attracted national attention when they protested the selection of Miss America, which they called an image that oppresses women. They all threw bras, girdles, curlers, false eyelashes, wigs, and other things they called women's garbage into a freedom trash can. A sheep was crowned Miss America. More important, people were beginning to speak of women's liberation. Some of the New York radical women shortly afterward formed WITCH, Women's International Terrorist Conspiracy from Hell, and its members, dressed as witches, appeared suddenly on the floor of the New York Stock Exchange. A leaflet put out by WITCH in New York said, "WITCH lives and laughs in every woman. She is the free part of each of us. Beneath the shy smiles, the acquiescence to absurd male domination, the makeup or flesh-suffocating clothes our sick society demands, there is no joining witch. If you are a woman and dare to look within yourself, you are a witch. You make your own rules." WITCH in Washington, D.C., protested at the United Fruit Company for the corporation's activities in the Third World and its treatment of its women office workers. In Chicago, it protested the firing of a radical feminist teacher named Marlene Dixon. Poor women, black women, expressed the universal problem of women in their own way. In 1964, Robert Coles, Children of Crisis, interviewed a black woman from the South recently moved to Boston, who spoke of the desperation of her life, the difficulty of finding happiness. "To me, having a baby inside me is the only time I'm really alive." Without talking specifically about their problems as women, many women among the poor did as they had always done, quietly organized neighborhood people to fight injustices, to get needed services. In the mid-1960s, 10,000 black people in a community in Atlanta called Vine City joined together to help one another. They set up a thrift shop, a nursery, a medical clinic, monthly family suppers, a newspaper, a family counseling service. One of the organizers, Helen Howard, told Gerda Lerner, Black Women in White America, about it. "I organized this neighborhood organization. Two men and six ladies started it. That was a hard pull. A lot of people joined in later. For about 5 months, we had meetings pretty near every night. We learned how to work with other people. A lot of people were afraid to really do anything. You were afraid to go to the city hall or ask for anything. You didn't even ask the landlord for anything. You were afraid of him. Then we had meetings, and then we weren't afraid so much anymore. The way we got this playground, we blocked off the street, wouldn't let anything come through. We wouldn't let the trolley bus come through. The whole neighborhood was in it. Took record players and danced. It went on for a week. We didn't get arrested. There was too many of us. So then the city put up this playground for the kids. A woman named Patricia Robinson wrote a pamphlet called Poor Black Woman, in which she connected the problems of women with the need for basic social change. Rebellion by poor black women, the bottom of a class hierarchy heretofore not discussed, places the question of what kind of society will the poor black woman demand and struggle for. Already she demands the right to have birth control, like middle-class black and white women. She is aware that it takes two to oppress, and that she and other poor people no longer are submitting to oppression, in this case, genocide. She allies herself with the have-nots in the wider world and their revolutionary struggles. She had been forced by historical conditions to withdraw the children from male dominance and to educate and support them herself. In this very process, male authority and exploitation are seriously weakened. Further, she realizes that the children will be used as all poor children have been used through history, as poorly paid mercenaries fighting to keep or put an elite group in power. Through these steps, she has begun to question aggressive male domination and the class society which enforces it, capitalism. In 1970, Dorothy Bolden, a laundry worker in Atlanta and mother of six, told why in 1968 she began organizing women doing housework into the National Domestic Workers Union. She said, "I think women should have a voice in making decisions in their community for betterment, because this woman in the slum is scuffling hard, and she's got a very good, intelligent mind to do things, and she's been overlooked for so many years. I think she should have a voice." Women tennis players organized. A woman fought to be a jockey, won her case, became the first woman jockey. Women artists picketed the Whitney Museum, charging sex discrimination in a sculptor show. Women journalists picketed the Gridiron Club in Washington, which excluded women. By the start of 1974, women's studies programs existed at 78 institutions, and about 2,000 courses on women were being offered at about 500 campuses. Women's magazines and newspapers began appearing, locally and nationally, and books on women's history and the movement came out in such numbers that some bookstores had special sections for them. The very jokes on television, some sympathetic, some caustic, showed how national was the effect of the movement. Certain television commercials, which women felt humiliated them, were eliminated after protest. In 1967, after lobbying by women's groups, President Johnson signed an executive order banning sex discrimination in federally connected employment. And in the years that followed, women's groups demanded that this be enforced. Over 1,000 suits were initiated by NOW, National Organization for Women, formed in 1966, against U.S. corporations charging sex discrimination. The right to abortion became a major issue. Before 1970, about 1 million abortions were done every year, of which only about 10,000 were legal. Perhaps a third of the women having illegal abortions, mostly poor people, had to be hospitalized for complications. How many thousands died as a result of these illegal abortions, no one really knows. But the illegalization of abortion clearly worked against the poor, for the rich could manage either to have their baby or to have their abortion under safe conditions. Court actions to do away with the laws against abortions were begun in over 20 states between 1968 and 1970, and public opinion grew stronger for the right of women to decide for themselves without government interference. In the book, Sisterhood is Powerful, an important collection of women's writing around 1970, an article by Lucinda Sisler, Unfinished Business, Birth Control, said that Abortion is a woman's right. No one can veto her decision and compel her to bear a child against her will. In the spring of 1969, a Harris poll showed that 64% of those polled thought the decision on abortion was a private matter. Finally, in early 1973, the Supreme Court decided, Roe v. Wade, Doe v. Bolton, that the state could prohibit abortions only in the last 3 months of pregnancy, that it could regulate abortion for health purposes during the second 3 months of pregnancy, and during the first 3 months, a woman and her doctor had the right to decide. There was a push for child care centers, and although women did not succeed in getting much help from government, thousands of cooperative child care centers were set up. Women also began to speak openly, for the first time, about the problem of rape. Each year, 50,000 rapes were reported, and many more were unreported. Women began taking self-defense courses. There were protests against the way police treated women, interrogated them, insulted them, when women filed rape charges. A book by Susan Brownmiller, Against Our Will, was widely read. It is a powerful, indignant history and analysis of rape, suggesting self-defense, individual or collective. Fighting back, on a multiplicity of levels, that is the activity we must engage in together, if we, women, are to redress the imbalance and rid ourselves and men of the ideology of rape. Rape can be eradicated, not merely controlled or avoided on an individual basis, but the approach must be long-range and cooperative, and must have the understanding and goodwill of many men as well as women. Many women were active in trying to get a constitutional amendment, ERA, Equal Rights Amendment, passed by enough states. But it seemed clear that even if it became law, it would not be enough. That what women had accomplished had come through organization, action, protest. Even where the law was helpful only if backed by action. Shirley Chisholm, a black congresswoman, said, "The law cannot do it for us. We must do it for ourselves. Women in this country must become revolutionaries. We must refuse to accept the old, the traditional roles and stereotypes. We must replace the old negative thoughts about our femininity with positive thoughts and positive action." Perhaps the most profound effect of the women's movement of the 60s, beyond the actual victories on abortion in job equality, was called consciousness raising, often done in women's groups, which met in homes all across the country. This meant the rethinking of roles, the rejection of inferiority, the confidence in self, a bond of sisterhood, a new solidarity of mother and daughter. The Atlanta poet Esther Seton wrote Her Life. "This is the picture that keeps forming in my mind. My young mother, barely 17, cooking their kosher dinner on the coal stove, that first winter in Vermont. And my father, mute in his feelings, except when he shouted, eating to show his love. 50 years later, her blue eyes would grow cold with the shock of that gray house, and the babies one after another, and the doctor who said, 'If you don't want any more children, move out of the house.'" For the first time, the sheer biological uniqueness of women was openly discussed. Some theorists, Shulamith Firestone in The Dialectics of Sex, for instance, thought this was more fundamental to their oppression than any particular economic system. It was liberating to talk frankly about what had for so long been secret, hidden, cause for shame and embarrassment. Menstruation, masturbation, menopause, abortion, lesbianism. One of the most influential books to appear in the early 70s was a book assembled by 11 women in the Boston Women's Health Book Collective called Our Bodies, Ourselves. It contained an enormous amount of practical information on women's anatomy, on sexuality and sexual relationships, on lesbianism, on nutrition and health, on rape, self-defense, venereal disease, birth control, abortion, pregnancy, childbirth, and menopause. More important even than the information, the charts, the photos, the candid exploration of the previously unmentioned, was the mood of exuberance throughout the book, the enjoyment of the body, the happiness with the newfound understanding, the new sisterhood with young women, middle-aged women, older women. They quoted the English suffragette Christabel Pankhurst. Remember the dignity of your womanhood. Do not appeal, do not beg, do not grovel. Take courage, join hands, stand beside us, fight with us. The fight began, many women were saying, with the body, which seemed to be the beginning of the exploitation of women as sex plaything, weak and incompetent, as pregnant woman, helpless, as middle-aged woman, no longer considered beautiful, as older woman, to be ignored, set aside. A biological prison had been created by men and society. As Adrienne Rich said, of Woman Born, "Women are controlled by lashing us to our bodies," she wrote. I have a very clear, keen memory of myself the day after I was married. I was sweeping a floor. Probably the floor did not really need to be swept. Probably I simply did not know what else to do with myself. But as I swept that floor, I thought, now I am a woman. This is an age-old action. This is what women have always done. I felt I was bending to some ancient form, too ancient to question. This is what women have always done. As soon as I was visibly and clearly pregnant, I felt for the first time in my adolescent and adult life not guilty. The atmosphere of approval in which I was bathed, even by strangers on the street, it seemed was like an aura I carried with me in which doubts, fears, misgivings met with absolute denial. This is what women have always done. Rich said women could use the body as a resource rather than a destiny. Patriarchal system, she said, whether under capitalism or socialism, limited women's bodies to their own needs. She discussed the training of passivity in women. Generations of schoolgirls were raised on Little Women, where Jo is told by her mother, "I am angry nearly every day of my life, Jo, but I have learned not to show it, and I still hope to learn not to feel it, though it may take me another 40 years to do so." Male doctors used instruments to bring out children, replacing the sensitive hands of midwives in the era of anesthetized, technologized childbirth. Rich disagreed with her fellow feminist Firestone, who wanted to change the biological inevitability of childbirth because it is painful and a source of subordination. She wanted, under different social conditions, to make childbirth a source of physical and emotional joy. One could not talk of Freud's ignorance of women, Rich said, as his one blind spot, which implied that in other matters his vision was clear. Such ignorance distorts all. There is a dilemma of the body. I know no woman, virgin, mother, lesbian, married, celibate, whether she earns her keep as a housewife or cocktail waitress or scanner of brainwaves, for whom her body is not a fundamental problem. Its clouded meaning, its fertility, its desire, its so-called frigidity, its bloody speech, its silences, its changes and mutilations, its rapes and ripenings. Her reply to this, the repossession of our bodies, a world in which every woman is the presiding genius of her own body, as a basis for bringing forth not just children, but new visions, new meanings, a new world. For most women who were not intellectuals, the question was even more immediate. How to eliminate hunger, suffering, subordination, humiliation in the here and now. A woman named Johnny Tillman wrote in 1972, I'm a woman. I'm a black woman. I'm a poor woman. I'm a fat woman. I'm a middle-aged woman, and I'm on welfare. I have raised 6 children. I grew up in Arkansas, worked there for 15 years in a laundry, moved to California. In 1963, I got too sick to work anymore. Friends helped me to go on welfare. Welfare is like a traffic accident. It can happen to anybody, but especially it happens to women. And that is why welfare is a women's issue. For a lot of middle-class women in this country, women's liberation is a matter of concern. For women on welfare, it's a matter of survival. Welfare, she said, was like a super sexist marriage. You trade in a man for the man. The man runs everything, controls your money. She and other welfare mothers organized a national welfare rights organization. They urged that women be paid for their work, housekeeping, child rearing. No woman can be liberated until all women get off their knees. In the problem of women was the germ of a solution, not only for their oppression, but for everybody's. The control of women in society was ingeniously effective. It was not done directly by the state. Instead, the family was used, men to control women, women to control children, all to be preoccupied with one another, to turn to one another for help, to blame one another for trouble, to do violence to one another when things weren't going right. Why could this not be turned around? Could women liberating themselves, children freeing themselves, men and women beginning to understand one another, find the source of their common oppression outside rather than in one another? Perhaps then they could create nuggets of strength in their own relationships, millions of pockets of insurrection. They could revolutionize thought and behavior in exactly that seclusion of family privacy which the system had counted on to do its work of control and indoctrination. And together, instead of at odds, male, female, parents, children, they could undertake the changing of society itself. It was a time of uprisings. If there could be rebellion inside that most subtle and complex of prisons, the family, it was reasonable that there be rebellions in the most brutal and obvious of prisons, the penitentiary system itself. In the 60s and early 70s, those rebellions multiplied. They also took on an unprecedented political character and the ferocity of class war, coming to a climax at Attica, New York, in September of 1971. The prison had arisen in the United States as an attempt at Quaker reform to replace mutilation, hanging, exile, the traditional punishments during colonial times. The prison was intended, through isolation, to produce repentance and salvation. But prisoners went insane and died in that isolation. By mid-19th century, the prison was based on hard labor, along with various punishments, sweat boxes, iron yokes, solitary. The approach was summed up by the warden at the Ossining, New York Penitentiary. In order to reform a criminal, you must first break his spirit. That approach persisted. Prison officials would convene annually to congratulate themselves on the progress being made. The president of the American Correctional Association, delivering the annual address in 1966, described the new edition of the Manual of Correctional Standards. It permits us to linger, if we will, at the gates of Correctional Valhalla, with an abiding pride in the sense of a job superbly done. We may be proud, we may be satisfied, we may be content. He said this just after, in the midst of, and just before, the most intense series of prison uprisings the country had ever seen. There had always been prison riots. A wave of them in the 1920s ended with a riot at Clinton, New York, a prison of 1,600 inmates, which was suppressed with 3 prisoners killed. Between 1950 and 1953, more than 50 major riots occurred in American prisons. In the early 1960s, prisoners on a work gang in Georgia, smashing rocks, used the same sledgehammers to break their legs to call attention to their situation of daily brutality. At San Quentin Prison in California, which housed 4,000 prisoners, there was a series of revolts in the late 60s, a race riot in 1967, a united black-white general strike in early 1968 that shut down almost all the prison industries, and then a second strike that summer. At the Queens House of Detention on Long Island in New York in the fall of 1970, prisoners took over the jail, took hostages, issued demands. The prisoners' negotiating committee included 4 blacks, 1 Puerto Rican, 1 white. They demanded immediate bail hearings on 47 cases that they said were examples of racism in the granting of bail. Judges came inside the prison, granted some paroles and reductions, and the hostages were released. But when the prisoners continued to hold out, police stormed the jail with tear gas and clubs, and the revolt was over. Around the same time in November 1970, in Folsom Prison in California, a work stoppage began which became the longest prison strike in the history of the United States. Most of the 2,400 prisoners held out in their cells for 19 days without food in the face of threats and intimidation. The strike was broken with a combination of force and deception, and 4 of the prisoners were sent on a 14-hour ride to another prison, shackled and naked on the floor of a van. One of the rebels wrote, "The spirit of awareness has grown. The seed has been planted." The prisons in the United States had long been an extreme reflection of the American system itself. The stark life differences between rich and poor, the racism, the use of victims against one another, the lack of resources of the underclass to speak out, the endless reforms that changed little. Dostoevsky once said, "The degree of civilization in a society can be judged by entering its prisons." It had long been true, and prisoners knew this better than anyone, that the poorer you were, the more likely you were to end up in jail. This was not just because the poor committed more crimes. In fact, they did. The rich did not have to commit crimes to get what they wanted. The laws were on their side. But when the rich did commit crimes, they often were not prosecuted, and if they were, they could get out on bail, hire clever lawyers, get better treatment from judges. Somehow, the jails ended up full of poor black people. In 1969, there were 502 convictions for tax fraud. Such cases, called white-collar crimes, usually involve people with a good deal of money. Of those convicted, 20% ended up in jail. The fraud averaged $190,000 per case. Their sentences averaged 7 months. That same year, for burglary and auto theft, crimes of the poor, 60% ended up in prison. The auto thefts averaged $992. The sentences averaged 18 months. The burglaries averaged $321. The sentences averaged 33 months. Willard Galen, a psychiatrist, relates Partial Justice, a case which, with changes in details, could be multiplied thousands of times. He had just interviewed 17 Jehovah's Witnesses who refused to register for the draft during the Vietnam War, and all had received 2-year sentences. He came to a young black man who had notified his draft board he could not, in conscience, cooperate with the draft because he was repelled by the violence of the Vietnam War. He received a 5-year sentence. Galen writes, "Hanks was the first 5-year sentence I had encountered. He was also the first black man." There were additional factors. "How was your hair then?" I asked. "Afro." "And what were you wearing?" "A dashiki." "Don't you think that might have affected your sentence?" "Of course." "Was it worth a year or two of your life?" I asked. "That's all of my life," he said, looking at me with a combination of dismay and confusion. Man, don't you know? That's what it's all about. Am I free to have my style? Am I free to have my hair? Am I free to have my skin? Of course, I said. You're right. Galen found enormous discretion given to judges in the handing out of sentences. In Oregon, of 33 men convicted of violating the draft law, 18 were put on probation. In southern Texas, of 16 men violating the same law, none was put on probation. And in southern Mississippi, every defendant was convicted and given the maximum of 5 years. In one part of the country, New England, the average sentence for all crimes was 11 months. In another part, the South, it was 78 months. But it wasn't simply a matter of North and South. In New York City, one judge handling 673 persons brought before him for public drunkenness, all poor, the rich get drunk behind closed doors, discharged 531 of them. Another judge, handling 566 persons on the same charge, discharged one person. With such power in the hands of the courts, the poor, the black, the odd, the homosexual, the hippie, the radical, are not likely to get equal treatment before judges who are almost uniformly white, upper middle class, orthodox. While in any one year, 1972 for instance, perhaps 375,000 people will be in jail, county or city, or in prisons, state or federal, and 54,000 in juvenile detention, there will also be 900,000 under probation and 300,000 on parole, a total of 1,600,000 people affected by the criminal justice system. Considering turnover, in any one year, several million people will come in and go out of this system. It is a population largely invisible to middle-class America. But if 20 million blacks could be invisible for so long, why not 4 or 5 million criminals? A study by the Children's Defense Fund, Thomas Cottle, Children in Jail, in the mid-70s, revealed that more than 900,000 young people under 18 are jailed in the course of a year. Anyone trying to describe the reality of prison falters. A man in Walpole Prison in Massachusetts wrote, "Every program that we get is used as a weapon against us. The right to go to school, to go to church, to have visitors, to write, to go to the movies. They all end up being weapons of punishment. None of the programs are ours. Everything is treated as a privilege that can be taken away from us. The result is insecurity, a frustration that keeps eating away at you." Another Walpole prisoner. "I haven't eaten in the mess hall for 4 years. I just couldn't take it anymore. You'd go into the serving line in the morning and 100 or 200 cockroaches would go running away from the trays. The trays were grimy and the food was raw or had dirt or maggots in it. Many a night I'd go hungry, living on peanut butter and sandwiches, getting a loaf of bread here or a hunk of bologna there. Other guys couldn't do that because they didn't have my connections or they didn't have money for the canteen." Communication with the outside world was difficult. Guards would tear up letters. Others would be intercepted and read. Jerry Souza, a prisoner at Walpole in 1970, sent two letters, one to a judge, the other to the parole board, to tell about a beating by guards. They went unanswered. 8 years later, at a court hearing, he discovered the prison authorities had intercepted them, never sent them out. The family suffered with the prisoner. "During the last lockup, my 4-year-old son sneaked off into the yard and picked me a flower. A guard in the tower called the warden's office, and a deputy came in with the state police at his side. He announced that if any child went into the yard and picked another flower, all visits would be terminated." The prison rebellions of the late 60s and early 70s had a distinctly different character than the earlier ones. The prisoners in the Queen's House of Detention referred to themselves as revolutionaries. All over the country, prisoners were obviously affected by the turmoil in the country, the black revolt, the youth upsurge, the anti-war movement. The events of those years underlined what prisoners already sensed, that whatever crimes they had committed, the greatest crimes were being committed by the authorities who maintained the prisons, by the government of the United States. The law was being broken daily by the president, sending bombers to kill, sending men to be killed, outside the Constitution, outside the highest law of the land. State and local officials were violating the civil rights of black people, which was against the law, and were not being prosecuted for it. Literature about the black movement, books on the war, began to seep into the prisons. The example set in the streets by blacks, by anti-war demonstrators, was exhilarating against a lawless system. Defiance was the only answer. It was a system which sentenced Martin Sostre, a 52-year-old black man running an Afro-Asian bookstore in Buffalo, New York, to 25 to 30 years in prison for allegedly selling $15 worth of heroin to an informer who later recanted his testimony. The recantation did not free Sostre. He could find no court, including the Supreme Court of the United States, to revoke the judgment. He spent 8 years in prison, was beaten 10 times by guards, spent 3 years in solitary confinement, battling and defying the authorities all the way until his release. Such injustice deserved only rebellion. There had always been political prisoners, people sent to jail for belonging to radical movements, for opposing war. But now a new kind of political prisoner appeared. The man or woman convicted of an ordinary crime, who in prison became awakened politically. Some prisoners began making connections between their personal ordeal and the social system. They then turned not to individual rebellion, but to collective action. They became concerned amid an environment whose brutality demanded concentration on one's own safety, an atmosphere of cruel rivalry, for the rights and safety of others. George Jackson was one of these new political prisoners. In Soledad Prison, California, on an indeterminate sentence for a $70 robbery, having already served 10 years of it, Jackson became a revolutionary. He spoke with a fury that matched his condition. "This monster, the monster they've engendered in me, will return to torment its maker, from the grave, the pit, the profoundest pit. Hurl me into the next existence. The descent into hell won't turn me. I'm going to charge them reparations in blood. I'm going to charge them like a maddened, wounded, rogue male elephant, ears flared, trunk raised, trumpet blaring, war without terms." A prisoner like this would not last. And when his book, Soledad Brother, became one of the most widely read books of black militancy in the United States, by prisoners, by black people, by white people, perhaps this ensured he would not last. "All my life I've done exactly what I wanted to do, just when I wanted, no more, perhaps less sometimes, but never any more, which explains why I had to be jailed. I never adjusted. I haven't adjusted even yet, with half of my life already in prison." He knew what might happen. Born to a premature death, a menial subsistence wage worker, odd job man, the cleaner, the caught, the man under hatches, without bail, that's me, the colonial victim. Anyone who can pass the civil service examination today can kill me tomorrow with complete immunity. In August 1971, he was shot in the back by guards at San Quentin Prison while he was allegedly trying to escape. The state story, analyzed by Eric Mann in Comrade George, was full of holes. Prisoners in jails and state prisons all over the country knew, even before the final autopsy was in, even before later disclosures suggested a government plot to kill Jackson, that he had been murdered for daring to be a revolutionary in prison. Shortly after Jackson's death, there was a chain of rebellions around the country, in San Jose Civic Center Jail, in Dallas County Jail, in Suffolk County Jail in Boston, in Cumberland County Jail in Bridgeton, New Jersey, in Bexar County Jail in San Antonio, Texas. The most direct effect of the George Jackson murder was the rebellion at Attica Prison in September 1971, a rebellion that came from long, deep grievances, but that was raised to a boiling point by the news about George Jackson. Attica was surrounded by a 30-foot wall, 2 feet thick, with 14 gun towers. 54% of the inmates were black. 100% of the guards were white. Prisoners spent 14 to 16 hours a day in their cells. Their mail was read, their reading material restricted, their visits from families conducted through a mesh screen, their medical care disgraceful, their parole system inequitable, racism everywhere. How perceptive the prison administration was about these conditions can be measured by the comment of the superintendent of Attica, Vincent Mancusi, when the uprising began. "Why are they destroying their home?" Most of the Attica prisoners were there as a result of plea bargaining. Of 32,000 felony indictments a year in New York State, 4,000 to 5,000 were tried. The rest, about 75%, were disposed of by deals made under duress called plea bargaining, described as follows in the report of the Joint Legislative Committee on Crime in New York. The final climactic act in the plea bargaining procedure is a charade which in itself has aspects of dishonesty, which rival the original crime in many instances. The accused is made to assert publicly his guilt on a specific crime, which in many cases he has not committed. In some cases, he pleads guilty to a non-existing crime. He must further indicate that he is entering his plea freely, and that he is not doing so because of any promises made to him. In plea bargaining, the accused pleads guilty, whether he is or not, and saves the state the trouble of a trial in return for the promise of a less severe punishment. When Attica prisoners were up for parole, the average time of their hearing, including the reading of the file and deliberation among the three members, was 5.9 minutes. Then the decision was handed out with no explanation. The official report on the Attica uprising tells how an inmate-instructed sociology class there became a forum for ideas about change. Then there was a series of organized protest efforts, and in July an inmate manifesto setting forth a series of moderate demands, after which tensions at Attica had continued to mount, culminating in a day of protest over the killing of George Jackson at San Quentin, during which few inmates ate at lunch and dinner, and many wore black armbands. On September 9, 1971, a series of conflicts between prisoners and guards ended with a group of inmates breaking through a gate with a defective weld and taking over one of the four prison yards with 40 guards as hostages. Then followed 5 days in which the prisoners set up a remarkable community in the yard. A group of citizen observers invited by the prisoners included New York Times columnist Tom Wicker, who wrote A Time to Die. The racial harmony that prevailed among the prisoners, it was absolutely astonishing. That prison yard was the first place I had ever seen where there was no racism. One black prisoner later said, "I never thought whites could really get it on, but I can't tell you what the yard was like. I actually cried, it was so close. Everyone so together." After 5 days, the state lost patience. Governor Nelson Rockefeller approved a military attack on the prison. See Cinda Firestone's stunning film, Attica. National guardsmen, prison guards, and local police went in with automatic rifles, carbines, and submachine guns in a full-scale assault on the prisoners who had no firearms. 31 prisoners were killed. The first stories given the press by prison authorities said that 9 guards held hostage had their throats slashed by the prisoners during the attack. The official autopsies almost immediately showed this to be false. The 9 guards died in the same hail of bullets that killed the prisoners. The effects of Attica are hard to measure. 2 months after the revolt at Attica, men at Norfolk Prison in Massachusetts began to organize. On November 8, 1971, armed guards and state troopers, in a surprise raid, moved into the cells at Norfolk, pulled out 16 men, and shipped them out. A prisoner described the scene. "Between 1 and 2 last night, I was awakened. I've been a light sleeper since Vietnam, and I looked out my window. There were troopers and screws, lots, armed with sidearms and big clubs. They were going into dorms and taking people, all kinds of people. They took a friend of mine. Being pulled outside in our underwear at 1:30 in bare feet by 2 troopers and a house screw, looking at those troops with guns and masks and clubs, with the moon shining off the helmets, and the hate that you could see in their faces, thinking that this is where these guys live, with the guns and the hate and the helmets and masks. And you're trying to wake up, flashing on Kent State and Jackson and Chicago and Attica. Most of all, Attica." That same week at Concord Prison in Massachusetts, another raid. It was as if everywhere in the weeks and months after Attica, the authorities were taking preventive action to break up organizing efforts among the prisoners. Jerry Souza, a young leader of the prison reform movement at Concord, was taken away, dumped into Walpole in the middle of the night, and immediately put into 9 Block, the dreaded segregation unit. He had been there only a short time when he managed to get a report out to friends. The content of this report tells much about what was happening before and after Attica to the thinking of prisoners. "We are writing a somber report regarding the circumstances and events leading up to and surrounding the death of prisoner Joseph Chesnulovich, which occurred here an hour ago in 9 Block. Since Christmas Eve, vicious prison guards here in 9 Block have created a reign of terror directed toward us prisoners. 4 of us have been beaten, one who was prisoner Donald King. In an attempt to escape constant harassment and inhuman treatment, prisoner George Hayes ate razor blades, and prisoner Fred Ahern swallowed a needle. They were both rushed to Mass General Hospital. This evening at 6 p.m., prison guards Baptist, Sainsbury, and Montiega turned a fire extinguisher containing a chemical foam on Joe, then slammed the solid steel door, sealing him in his cell, and walked away, voicing threats of, 'We'll get that punk.' At 9:25 p.m., Joe was found dead. Prison authorities as well as news media will label little Joe's death a suicide, but the men here in Block 9 who witnessed this murder know. But are we next?" What was happening was the organization of prisoners, the caring of prisoners for one another, the attempt to take the hatred and anger of individual rebellion and turn it into collective effort for change. On the outside, something new was also happening: the development of prison support groups all over the country, the building of a body of literature about prisons. There were more studies of crime and punishment, a growing movement for the abolition of prisons on the grounds that they did not prevent crime or cure it, but expanded it. Alternatives were discussed: community houses in the short run, except for the incorrigibly violent, guaranteed minimum economic security in the long run. The prisoners were thinking about issues beyond prison, victims other than themselves and their friends. In Walpole Prison, a statement asking for American withdrawal from Vietnam was circulated. It was signed by every single prisoner, an amazing organizing feat by a handful of inmates. One Thanksgiving day there, most of the prisoners, not only in Walpole but in 3 other prisons, refused to eat the special holiday meal, saying they wanted to bring attention to the hungry all over the United States. Prisoners worked laboriously on lawsuits, and some victories were won in the courts. The publicity around Attica, the community of support, had its effect. Although the Attica rebels were indicted on heavy charges and faced double and triple life terms, the charges were finally dropped. But in general, the courts declare their unwillingness to enter the closed, controlled world of the prison. And so the prisoners remained as they had been so long, on their own. Even where an occasional victory came in the courts, it turned out on close reading to leave things not much different. In 1973, Pecunier v. Martinez, the U.S. Supreme Court declared unconstitutional certain mail censorship regulations of the California Department of Corrections. But when one looked closely, the decision, with all its proud language about First Amendment liberty, said, "We hold that censorship of prison mail is justified if the following criteria are met. When the censorship could be said to further an important or substantial government interest, or where it was in the substantial government interests of security, order, and rehabilitation, censorship would be allowed." In 1978, the Supreme Court ruled that the news media do not have guaranteed rights of access to jails and prisons. It ruled also that prison authorities could forbid inmates to speak to one another, assemble, or spread literature about the formation of a prisoner's union. It became clear, and prisoners seemed to know this from the start, that their condition would not be changed by law, but by protest, organization, resistance, the creation of their own culture, their own literature, the building of links with people on the outside. There were more outsiders now who knew about prisons. Tens of thousands of Americans had spent time behind bars in the civil rights and anti-war movements. They had learned about the prison system and could hardly forget their experiences. There was a basis now for breaking through the long isolation of the prisoners from the community and finding support there. In the mid-70s, this was beginning to happen. It was a time of upsurge. Women, guarded in their very homes, rebelled. Prisoners, put out of sight and behind bars, rebelled. The greatest surprise was still to come. It was thought that the Indians, once the only occupants of the continent, then pushed back and annihilated by the white invaders, would not be heard from again. In the last days of the year 1890, shortly after Christmas, the last massacre of Indians took place at Pine Ridge, South Dakota, near Wounded Knee Creek. Sitting Bull, the great Sioux leader, had just been assassinated by Indian police in the pay of the United States, and the remaining Sioux sought refuge at Pine Ridge, 120 men and 230 women and children, surrounded by U.S. cavalry with two Hotchkiss guns capable of hurling shells over 2 miles, on a rise overlooking the camp. When the troopers ordered the Indians to turn over their weapons, one of them fired his rifle. The soldiers then let loose with their carbines, and the big guns on the hill shelled the teepees. When it was over, between 200 and 300 of the original 350 men, women, and children were dead. The 25 soldiers who died were mostly hit by their own shrapnel or bullets, since the Indians had only a few guns. The Indian tribes, attacked, subdued, starved out, had been divided up by putting them on reservations where they lived in poverty. In 1887, an Allotment Act tried to break up the reservations into small plots of land owned by individual Indians to turn them into American-type small farmers. But much of this land was taken by white speculators, and the reservations remained. Then, during the New Deal, with a friend of the Indians, John Collier, in charge of the Bureau of Indian Affairs, there was an attempt to restore tribal life. But in the decades that followed, no fundamental change took place. Many Indians stayed on the impoverished reservations. The younger ones often left. An Indian anthropologist said, "An Indian reservation is the most complete colonial system in the world that I know about." For a time, the disappearance or amalgamation of the Indians seemed inevitable. Only 300,000 were left at the turn of the century, from the original million or more in the area of the United States. But then the population began to grow again, as if a plant left to die refused to do so, began to flourish. By 1960, there were 800,000 Indians, half on reservations, half in towns all over the country. The autobiographies of Indians show their refusal to be absorbed by the white man's culture.